Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Chapter 3, Text 16. Evam pravartitam chakram nanuvarta yatiha yaha. Aghayar Indriya Ramo Mogham Partha Sajivati. My dear Arjuna, one who does not follow in human life the cycle of sacrifice thus established by the Vedas certainly leads a life full of sin. Living only for the satisfaction of the senses, such a person lives in vain. Purport. The mammonist philosophy of work very hard and enjoy sense gratification is condemned herein by the Lord. Therefore, for those who want to enjoy this material world, the above-mentioned cycle of performing yajñas is absolutely necessary. One who does not follow such regulations is living a very risky life, being condemned more and more. By nature's law, this human form of life is specifically meant for self-realization, in either of the three ways, namely karma yoga, jnana yoga, or bhakti yoga. There is no necessity of rigidly following the performances of the prescribed yajñas for the transcendentalists who are above vice and virtue, but those who are engaged in sense gratification require purification by the above-mentioned cycle of yajna performances. There are different kinds of activities. Those who are not Krishna conscious are certainly engaged in sensory consciousness. Therefore, they need to execute pious work. The yajna system is planned in such a way that sensory conscious persons may satisfy their desires without becoming entangled in the reaction of sense gratificatory work. The prosperity of the world depends not on our own efforts, but on the background arrangement of the Supreme Lord directly carried out by the demigods. Therefore, the yajnas are directly aimed at the particular demigods mentioned in the Vedas. Indirectly, it is the practice of Krishna consciousness, because when one masters the performance of yajnas, one is sure to become Krishna conscious. But if by performing yajnas one does not become Krishna conscious, such principles are counted as only moral codes. One should not therefore limit his progress only to the point of moral codes, but should transcend them to attain Krishna consciousness. Evang pravartitam chakrang nanuvarta yahi yaha. Aghaya indriya ramo moghang partha sajivati. My dear Arjuna, one who does not follow in human life the cycle of sacrifice thus established by the Vedas certainly leads a life full of sin, living only for the satisfaction of the senses. Such a person lives in vain. I'd really like to put this up a bit more. I'll get some stand. Om Agyana Timirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Srishtam Manamapi Shachiputra Matra Swarupam Rupam Tasya Grajamurupurim Maturim Goshtavatim Radha Kundam Girivaramaho Radhika Madhavasham Prapto Yasya Pratita Kripaya Shri Gurum Tamnatosmi Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Atav Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavanscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagarna Raghunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagarna Lalita Shri Vishakha. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada's purport here is likely to be difficult to follow for persons who are not familiar with the broader corpus of his writings. Herein, Srila Prabhupada discusses Vedic society based on sacrifices. He's discussing a highly developed society, maybe not developed in the sense of skyscraper buildings and 12-lane highways, but highly developed in morals, religious rituals, highly structured and ordered society. And Srila Prabhupada makes the comment, which may surprise some readers, that simply to be moral, that isn't enough. One has to go beyond that. Well, you might think that civilization means morals. That's a basic feature of society, is that there are morals which distinguish human society from animal society, or the existence of the animals. Now, the difference between human society and animal society is also discussed within the corpus of Vedic literature. Ahara nidra bhaya maithunam cha samanyam etat pashubhya naranam. Humans and animals eat, sleep, have sex, and fear, which means it leads to defense mechanisms. So what's the difference between a human and an animal? Dharmo hiteyusham adhiko vishesham dharmena hina pashubhya naranam. The difference between a human and an animal is dharma, which is the word dharma is variously translated as duty, religion, religious sense. There's another version of this verse, jnano hiteyusham adhiko vishesham. Knowledge is that which distinguishes humans from animals. Now, human society is definitely based on levels of knowledge higher than animals. Animals also have knowledge. The lower species have some kinds of knowledge which humans up to the present cannot imitate. For instance, humans can't build nests as birds can. They might be able to imitate building a nest. Humans, unlike certain species of birds, they can't, without pre-planning, they cannot navigate their way from one part of the world to the other. But certainly, overall, human society is distinguished from animal society by knowledge. But mostly that knowledge is employed for sophisticated activities of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. So actually, generally speaking, in the Vedic corpus, the word jnana, or knowledge, or generally speaking, or often, the word knowledge, jnana, refers to knowledge of the self, as Srila Prabhupada writes in this purport, that he discusses self-realization. Where does he write that? This human form of life is specifically meant for self-realization. So knowledge in the Vedic understanding, in Vedic society, is understood to mean the knowledge of self-realization, or the knowledge that leads to self-realization. Human society is considered more advanced the more that it develops in sophistication. There are aboriginal kinds of humans who live by hunting and gathering, live by hunting with bows and arrows, for instance, and who gather fruits and grains that grow without cultivation. So that's a very low level of society. As society becomes more complex, more systems are required to regulate humans in their eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and in various ways seeking sense gratification. That is required. Otherwise, if human society works on the principle only of might makes right, then the cooperation required for humans to live a life better than that of simply fighting with each other, that is lost. In other words, as society progresses, cooperation is considered very important, not just competition. The strongest wins, because the might makes right may work to some extent, but if there is cooperation, then everyone can live peacefully and with prosperity also. Whereas if there's only trying to force people to do what you want, then people may run away and go somewhere else, or you may kill them, or so they're not able to work for you. Overall, society is seen to advance when there is cooperation. But that requires regulation also, to regulate society. For instance, we may say, okay, let's all cooperate. So different people are assigned different roles. That's another important part of human society. That maybe they're also in the ant society or the bee society, that different classes of ants and different classes of bees have different roles which naturally accrue to them by birth. In human society, we require farmers and then people who make the produce of the land available to persons elsewhere. In other words, the grains may be grown in one place and distributed somewhere else. Generally, that's the job of merchants to purchase grains from farmers and then sell the product to people in the cities, in general in societies like that. In communistic society, there was a different system of collection and distribution. But let's just take that as an example. The merchant has to purchase, but then a government is required to see that the farmers get properly rewarded so that they can continue to go on growing food, and that the merchants, they don't make excessive profit. They don't stash grains and then sell them off at a very high place by black marketeering. And regulation is required. Now, we may say, well, if everyone was very moral, then it wouldn't be required. But it is required because the tendency of people is to want more and more and more and more for themselves, to try to take advantage of others. And then comes the question of philosophy. What is right and what is wrong? The regulation means there are laws What are those laws? Who's going to decide? For instance, a classical question in the philosophy of law, that there's property is demarcated. One man's property is next to another man's property. And one man's property, there is a fruit tree. The tree, the trunk, is on one man's property, but much of the fruit, much of the tree expands itself, so much of the fruit overhangs the property of another person. So to whom should that fruit accrue? To the person who raised the tree, or in whose property that the trunk of the tree is, or does the person over whose property the tree hangs, so that much of the fruit goes or would naturally fall there, who does that fruit belong to? So these are the kind of questions that arise, moral questions. Man cannot be without philosophy. There is a sense of right and wrong which is not there in lower species. It may be there in a very crude way. Just like, for instance, a dog can be trained to do what is right and wrong according to what his master wants him to do. So he may say, good boy, to the dog, or bad boy. And then the dog knows he's doing something good or bad. But he doesn't have a moral sense of what is right and wrong. This is only in human society. Man cannot live without a sense of right and wrong. Even in a tribal society, then they'll have in a very crude way, say a very crude level of human society, then one member of a tribe may consider that it is good to act for our own tribe, and it is good to act against another tribe. And then when society develops more, we may think, no, well, it's good to act for all different tribes, not only for our own tribe. We have to consider the well-being of others also. And that may extend further, that we may think, instead of hunting the animals, why not let them live in peace and not kill the animals? We can live without killing animals, so the sense of morality or goodness becomes extended. And then again, other questions may come. All right, we're not going to kill any animals, but now we are overrun by rats who are destroying our crops. What do we do? Should we kill the rats, or how shall we restrict them? The rats want to eat our grains. Are they our grains? We went to so much effort to grow them, and now the we have a infestation of rats. So all these very subtle questions arise in human society as to what is right and what is wrong, moral laws. And even if we decide what is right and what is wrong, then there comes the further question of reward and punishment. Even if someone is found out to have done something wrong, then how much should he be punished? That becomes another question. As one cartoon I remember seeing some years ago, very funny, black humor, that a man is hauled by a guard of the king's palace, hauled before the king, and said, this man was found loitering outside the palace. So the king said, have him hung, drawn, and quartered, which is a medieval, excruciatingly painful method of execution. Horrible, exceptionally prolonged and painful method of execution. So the guard asked, well, isn't that a bit excessive? And the king replied, okay, just shoot him. So it's black humor. It's funny because for a very minor offense to give such a major punishment as hung, drawn, and quartered, that's really excessive. So then to lessen the punishment, okay, just shoot him. But shooting is also far too excessive for such a minor offense. So then there arise whole questions of law, ethics, morals, and wisdom. Just like in if we say there's a king, let's say a king. If we say a king becomes easy nowadays. It becomes easy to understand the principles, whereas nowadays we generally don't have kings in democratic systems. It's difficult to know exactly who we are answerable to. We say the government in general. But okay, let's say a king. So wisdom is required for a king to govern also, because he has to administer justice. If he's too harsh, for instance, if he has some people executed for loitering outside the palace, which is hardly an offense at all anyway, then he'll become hated by his people. They won't trust him. They won't love him. They won't want to cooperate and serve him. And he may also, for being so harsh, acquire sinful reactions. On the other hand, if he's too lenient, then people take advantage and they do all kinds of, and at least the worst section of society will commit all kinds of crimes. And then the better people will be victimized by the worst people, because the king or the government is not strict enough. So where's the balance? It's very difficult. I mean, you can't exactly say where the balance is. So human society, the point I'm getting at is the human society is distinguished by morals. There must be moral. This should be done, this should not be done. And who's to say what is right and what is wrong? There may be moral questions or philosophical questions and discussions concerning that. But the government, at least in some spheres or many spheres, has to lay down the law. You can't say that, well, everyone can just live according to their own conceptions of right and wrong. There has to be a standard which everyone has to follow. And that has to be enforced by the government. And that may be discussed also by various enlightened people, that what should be done, what should not be done under various circumstances. So human society means that there must be knowledge and wisdom at a level significantly more than that of the animals. Knowledge in human society is not simply for how to, in a more sophisticated way, eat, sleep, have sex, enjoy the senses in various ways, and fight against our enemies. It must incorporate ideas of right and wrong, good and bad. Now, we might think that, well, modern society is very sophisticated and we have very sophisticated systems of democracy. And for maybe the last two centuries or more, it has generally been propagated by the white man that he is morally superior to others. But actually, we find a good example is that of America, both North America and South America. When the white man came and thought himself civilized, because he saw that the native Indians, as they called them, were living in a manner which the white man considered to be very primitive, because the white man had, for instance, guns. The white man had sophisticated machines, and using these weapons and sophisticated machines, they were eventually able to dominate the native Indians, whose descendants are now confined to reservations for them. The white man totally, more or less genocidically, destroyed that culture. But there was a culture there. The native Indians, they were very conscious that they are part of the whole ecosphere. And if they wouldn't kill any animals unless they felt they really needed to. They wouldn't cut trees unless they felt they needed to. And they would do some ritual for forgiveness. Of course, I'm speaking in a very broad way here because there were various tribes. But the point is they were all very conscious of their environment, and they didn't take from nature any more than they needed to because they considered themselves part of it. They, even though from the civilizational perspective, they may have appeared to be very primitive, but they had an understanding of themselves as being part of a mega organism, what we might call nature. So that is one kind of developed at some level spiritual intelligence, which the white man didn't have. For the white man, for fun, killed off, for instance, there were millions, literally millions, millions, tens of millions of passenger pigeons, which the white man killed for fun, and there are none left now in North America. There were thousands and thousands of bisons wandering the plains, which the white man killed for fun. So in many ways, although the white man was more sophisticated, but in terms of spiritualism, he was actually very primitive. And although he considered himself very moral, it was selective morality because it was all right in his understanding to kill the native Indians and the bisons and the passenger pigeons, and it was all right in his selective morality was such that it was all right to bring black people from Africa and use them as slaves. So it was the morality extended only among the white men and not among. Now, I'm not getting into a whole anti-white thing here in particular, but I'm just pointing out that that Srila Prabhupada writes here that one has to go higher than morality. What does that mean? Well, even actual morality, as we know it, it has to transcend simply systems whereby we can peacefully and cooperatively eat, sleep, mate, and defend. Such morality doesn't elevate us above animal consciousness. Animals eat, sleep, mate, and defend. And if our morality is simply to regulate eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, then it can very easily degrade into highly immoral acts, as was seen repeatedly in history. The great example, or the most famous example in the 20th century, being that of Nazi Germany. The Germans considered to be very cultured people in many ways, for their, especially in the fields of music, what we nowadays call classical music, and philosophy. But unfortunately, the whole society became overtaken by a philosophy whereby it was considered morally not just acceptable, but imperative for the for good, to be a good German, to be anti-Jew, anti-Gypsy, anti-homosexual, and to the extent that it was considered good to kill such people. So morality, if it doesn't go beyond being a means of regulating sense gratification, then it's really on the animal platform. And we see that going on at the present day, up to the present day, although various societies talk about morality, really what's going on in the world at the mega level, big, high level politics is might makes right. The big nations oppress small nations who don't toe their line. So the Vedic imperative is that to properly utilize human life, and again I'll study this, I'll read here, the Srila Prabhupada, the human form of life is specifically meant for self-realization. Self-realization means to understand that I am a living being, eternal living being, I'm presently in a certain body, which means that even though I might consider myself, due to my birth and my body, to be British or American or whatever, actually I have nothing to do with this body because I'm just temporarily within it. I'm an eternal living being, and the human form of life, which offers more intelligence than other forms of life, that intelligence, some of it must be used for living in this world, undoubtedly, how to live in this world and live cooperatively with others without exploiting others or without being exploited, and thus the questions of ethics and morals arise. But over and above that, one is to understand one's whole existential position. And the Vedic culture, that is, especially at its highest levels, is the Vedic culture that Srila Prabhupada alludes to in this purport, is specifically aimed at self-realization. Now, if we understand that we are eternal living beings, not only humans, but every species of life, we're all eternal. Aham bija pradapita, sarva yonishu kaunteya, murtiya sambhavantiyaha, tasang brahma mahadyone, aham bija pradapita. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna claims himself to be the seed-giving father of all living beings who take birth from the primordial nature, who attain bodies from the material nature. So all living beings are part and parcel of God, part and parcel in the sense that they're tiny little beings who are dependent upon the one supreme living being and are intimately connected with him. So with this understanding, one is to conduct one's life. And civilization which conducts itself not simply for regulating, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, but over and above. What is that over and above that? Well, we may say over and above that is music, art, philosophy, science. Okay, that's there, but it doesn't raise the consciousness beyond the understanding. Without specific knowledge that I am an eternal living being, then the other manifestations of human sophistication, they don't actually raise society above the level of the animal consciousness. So the intelligence that is there in the human life, that is meant for philosophical inquiry. Not just to understand what is good and bad in terms of our present existential situation, but in terms of our eternal existential situation. I'm British or I'm American, I'm in a male body, but what am I doing here? How did I get in this situation? Why am I suffering? That's a major question. So much of human endeavor is both individually and cooperatively is meant for trying to avoid suffering. But we cannot avoid suffering. Why? How can we get free from this? So these inquiries, they constitute the beginning of an actually advanced civilization. Atato Brahma Jignasa. The Vedanta Sutras begin with these words that now one should inquire into spiritual reality. Now means right now we should do it, but it also gives the idea that all right, we've been so many lifetimes investigating or being moral persons, trying to regulate our lives in a manner that we can live happily for sensual enjoyment. Now we have to come to a higher level of understanding. Otherwise, without this higher level anyway, then all endeavors at morality, they will in course of time degrade and corrupt. As the saying goes, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That need not be true. If someone in his heart is not corrupt, it suggests or this saying presupposes that everyone is at heart corrupt. But Vedic civilization is meant for purification, so that the heart is not corrupt. So it is possible to live in this world without exploiting others, even if one has the opportunity to do so. In this verse which we read, Lord Krishna is talking about the regulations of human society, or referring back to the previous verses, there are regulations in human society. Regulation is required. Because without that, chaos ensues. Regulation is required, but that regulation should be to not just to constrain people within a certain set of codes so that they don't rip each other to pieces or exploit them in less gory ways. But that regulation is meant to ultimately guide them toward self-realization. So this Vedic culture, as Lord Krishna explains here, will explain in the next chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, Chatur Varnyang Maya Sushtam Guna Karma Vibhaga Shaha. The Vedic society is a very sophisticated society based on the understanding that people are different, people have different abilities, people have different propensities, and people should be engaged accordingly, according to their abilities and propensities. Not that we try to make everyone the same in the name of equality. So they're very deep understanding and analysis of human nature and how human society should be lived. That is alluded to in Bhagavad Gita and Srila Prabhupada's extensive purports. They elaborate on that. And in his purports to Srimad Bhagavatam, he further elaborates on how society should be organized according to the Varnashram system, that there are different grades of humans. People have different responsibilities. There are the brahmanas, or the intellectuals, and the religious class, or those who perform religious rituals. There are the kshatriyas, who are the organizers, the protectors, the martial class, the administrative class. There are the vaishyas, who are the productive class, and they're engaged in production and distributions, especially production of food. That's the first necessity, as stated in Bhagavad Gita, very practical teachings of Krishna, anad bhavanti bhutani, that all living beings require food. Before philosophy, there has to be food. It turned out the Vedic society being based on a higher philosophical understanding, but it's not impractical. That's the understanding is there. Philosophy, yes, but first there has to be food. That has to be considered. And then there are the Shudras who are also divided into many, many different groups, who are basically unskilled or semi-skilled workers who assist in various ways within human society. So those divisions are recognized there in the Varnashram system. And actually such divisions are there throughout the world, but in the Varnashram system it's very deliberately instituted and structured. And apart from that, there are the four levels of life, brahmachari life, that's especially meant for the young boys who are going to be highly educated. They live as celibate students with very high discipline, with the being trained to understand that human life is ultimately meant for self-realization. Then there's the married, the next stage is married life. Then the next stage, retired life. Retired life in Vedic culture is not meant for watching TV and just growing old and rotting away and dying, but for gradually withdrawing from social activity, so one can concentrate before the body is completely worn out. One can concentrate with intensity on self-realization. And there is the renounced order of life, in which one completely withdraws from the ordinary activities of human society to totally concentrate on self-realization. So Vedic life is based on this understanding that human life is meant for self-realization. It's highly regulated. As Krishna says in this verse, one who does not follow these regulations, then they're simply living a life of sin. They're just living like animals. they're misusing their human form of life. So one of the purposes of this Krishna conscious movement is to reestablish Varnashram culture. It's a very ambitious project to convince people that human life is meant for self-realization. It doesn't really matter whether our country, as we in illusion we may think, our country is powerful, wealthy, our team wins the sports competition, or our country sends a module to the moon. These things don't matter. What matters is, ultimately, how we prepare ourselves for the future. We have to die. What will happen after that? These are all topics discussed in Bhagavad Gita. It requires much education to bring people to this understanding. And imparting of that education is one of the grave mandates of the members of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So I'm just giving a general idea here. There's so much more to be understood and discussed. It's not 5-minute YouTube feel good, or even a 30-minute or 1-hour YouTube make you feel good, insubstantial topic of discussion. Very deep topics that human society now more than ever requires to discuss. The members of the Krishna Conscious Movement are very much anxious to impart this knowledge to the people of the world, so that the human society at the present time, which is totally lost and misdirected, can pick itself up, get back on course, and reorganize society on the higher moral principles based on the understanding that human life is meant for self-realization. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.